Metcast, Friday, June 22nd, 2012. Hey, MetGeeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for MetGeeks by MetGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. You know what? Can you believe that this is the 400th episode of the MacCast? Seems like we should be having some sort of party or celebration or something like that, but I just realized that I just reached a milestone, and I didn't really have anything planned, nothing special. We'll just mark it and say, hey, 400 episodes. Thank you for staying subscribed for so long and being part of this community. It's really because of you that this thing happens. If no one was listening to me drone on into a microphone in my spare bedroom for this many years, then we would never have gotten here. So thank you for that. Thank you for supporting the show, whether you do it just by downloading the podcast every week or if you're a MacCast member. A special thank you to you for supporting the show. I'm able to do this in part because of folks like you. So thank you very, very much. And I think with that, we should probably get into the Mac news and stuff like that. Of course, we have to kick things off, though, by talking about one of our show sponsors, and that's Smile Software. Actually, exciting news from Smile. They just came out with a brand new version of Text Expander. Text Expander 4 was just released yesterday, and it is full of new stuff, jam-packed with new features. I think the list, there was a long bullet list in the press release of everything that's new in there. But probably the biggest one, and I think the one a lot of people are going to be really excited about, is expanded functionality in the fill-in fields. And even if you're a Text Expander user right now, you might not have even realized that there's fill-in fields in there. I think it's one of the best features of Text Expander, because basically what it does is it allows you to take what would be a standard kind of static snippet and make it dynamic. Like, how many times have you wanted to have a snippet where maybe it's a letter and you want to be able to fill in the person's name dynamically? Well, you can do that with the fill-in fields, and it gives you an opportunity to do that, to define fields within your snippet and then add data to them at expansion time. And with Text Expander 4, they now have a new multi-line text field snippet. They have pop-up menus, so you can create little drop-downs and even set defaults for what comes in there, but then you can change it at expansion time. And they have an optional text selection feature. I'm really excited to be playing around with this, because I'll oftentimes have a snippet, a long snippet, where I want to add in dynamic data dependent upon who I'm sending an email to. It's great for that sort of thing. So you can hit a checkbox and it'll add some dynamic information right there at expansion time. So if you're a current Text Expander customer, you're going to want to upgrade. If you haven't checked out Text Expander yet, you need to go over to the Smile website. You can get all the details on everything that's in this update and get information about the product, as well as all the other great products that Smile makes. As far as pricing, if you're going to upgrade, it's $15 for current users and free to any users who purchased after January 15th, 2012. And new users, it's just $34.95 US, and there is a family license available for home use for $44.95. So check it all out. SmileSoftware.com is the website. They have free trials available, so you can check it out, and I know you're going to love it. Big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. So you know that WWDC happened last week. We got the great new Retina MacBook Pros, and Apple announced OS X Mountain Lion coming in July next month, and they also gave us some more information about iOS 6, which is expected to be out in the fall. And as happens after WWDC, we start getting all kinds of additional information and stuff's coming out about the products and what's going to be in there. And one of the things that came out this week with respect to iOS 6 was something near and dear to my heart, being a podcaster, and that is that people noticed in the music app that podcasts were not in there. They were missing the podcast section, or when you try to go access podcasts, it would say you couldn't access them from the app. And so that started all kinds of speculation and wondering about what was going on. Why are podcasts not in there? Is Apple going to get rid of them? Turns out the rumor now is that Apple will roll out podcasts into their own native app from Apple. I'm a little bit excited about this and a little bit hesitant too, because there's some great third-party podcasting apps on iOS right now, Downcast, Instacast, Podcaster, great apps that you can grab podcasts with. But it'll be interesting to see what Apple does. iMore had reports that not only would there be a new app, but that that app would have sort of newsstand-type automatic content downloads, that Apple's going to be expanding that kind of functionality into all the different kinds of media types. So you can have a subscription, have it download, and sort of notify you that there's new podcasts available. A system like that would be ideal for podcasting and fit right in nicely with the operating system. If Apple does do their own standalone app, one thing that I hope they have is better support and more consistent support for the enhanced AAC podcast format. You who listen to the MacCast know that I do an enhanced AAC. You have chapters, you have bookmarks, and all kinds of great stuff. It's been kind of hit or miss as Apple pushes out updates with whether or not that functionality works or what happens with it. As a matter of fact, many of you know right now that for some reason, Apple did something in the iOS 5.1.1 update, and the chapter titles are all gone. Some people thought that I had literally removed them or stopped putting in the chapter titles. Nope, they're still in there. You can see them in iTunes, but on your iOS devices, they're no longer working. I've actually notified Apple about that. Was hoping they would push an update, but don't know. I'm hearing rumors that that might be fixed in iOS 6, at least for podcast playback. So that's good news, but it'd be great if they had better support and more robust support in a standalone app for enhanced AAC features. Also, another huge one for me, because I have the member show, support for protected feeds for subscriptions would be great, although I have a feeling that Apple may want a 30% cut of those subscriptions. I think Apple's going to go for a consistent experience across all forms of media. You know, they've been in this process of kind of diverging the media from the iTunes app and putting them into their own applications. So the idea that there's going to be a standalone app for podcasts makes a whole lot of sense. You know, you have books are in iBooks, you have your movies and TV shows in the video app now, you're going to have music in the music player, and then podcasts in its own app. I don't know what it would be called, maybe iPodcasts or something like that. And I'd also be curious to know what Apple's going to do with respect to audiobooks in iOS 6. Are they going to get their own app? Are they going to stay in music, or do they get moved into iBooks? Does it make sense for audiobooks to be in iBooks? I don't really know. There's also this separate report coming out that Apple may, in conjunction with spinning off podcasts into their own app, they may be developing a podcast producing technology that would get rolled in as well. I'm wondering if that would be something like iBooks Author. They've had a podcasting tool available for OS X server, but I don't think it was ever really kind of expanded into something that would be just a podcast creation app. GarageBand has a lot of those features, so I don't know if that would mean they'd roll out the GarageBand features into sort of a podcast producer application. And if they're doing that, that seems to be in line with this idea that I've had for a while, that Apple is looking to develop a full strategy for self-publishing across all forms of media. So with books, you're going to have iBooks Author to create the content and then direct distribution into the iTunes store for selling that content, getting it out to people. I could imagine Apple doing a similar thing for video and TV shows and movies and things like that, and also for podcasts. Why not? Why not have a podcast producer and I can flow it right into iTunes automatically? That's where most people subscribe. And if they add on a subscription portion, that might help out a lot of authors as well, to help kind of monetize that content and stuff like that. So it'd be really interesting to see what's coming in iOS 6 and also, I guess, OS X Mountain Lion. I would imagine there'd be some tools for the Mac coming along with that. So I was kind of excited to hear that news. A little bit hesitant at first when I heard podcasts weren't in there, but sounds like it's going to be a great thing in the long run. And while we're talking about WWDC, Apple did post all of the WWDC sessions. They're available to developers through the developer website at developer.apple.com. They're also available in iTunes through iTunes U. So for all those developers who weren't able to attend, it sold out, in the first few hours? You can attend virtually, or at least the sessions, by just going to your developer account. And for those of you who aren't developers and maybe want access to the content, you know you can sign up for a free developer account if you go to developer.apple.com. And even with a free account, you can get access to all of that great WWDC content. So if you even have an inkling of that sort of thing, you know, I haven't delved personally into iOS development. I've kind of dabbled in it a little bit, but being a web developer, there's a whole bunch of sessions on doing web development and web apps and optimizing. And I noticed one of the sessions in there is optimizing your graphics, your web graphics for the new high-res screens and the Retina screens and stuff like that. So I'm curious to find out a little bit more information on how to do that, how to optimize my website and make it look the best on a Retina device as well as non-Retina devices in the future. So I'll probably be checking in on that session. And you can do it all. Just head to developer.apple.com. Lots of new rumors this week surrounding the next generation iPhone. I guess that's the next device that's on the block for being updated by Apple. It's expected to be out in the fall. TechCrunch is claiming that they verified with a bunch of different sources that Apple is going to be moving to a new smaller connector on the next gen iPhone. So the 30-pin dock connector is going away. They're saying this new connector is going to be a 19-pin connector. Some people were speculating that it just might be a standard micro USB connector, although the TechCrunch report, I think, was saying that it is a proprietary connector. I can't imagine Apple moving to a standardized connector. And as a matter of fact, Robert Scoble was claiming in the comments of the post that TechCrunch put up that Apple's actually moving the other direction, going more proprietary, and they're going to build technology into the connector and the cable to ensure that only Apple authorized accessories are able to use that new dock connector. Scoble was saying there's actually going to be chips built in there. I would imagine sort of like the Thunderbolt cables where it can control what devices and what things are able to use that connector. TechCrunch was saying that they have three separate sources that are all telling them sort of the same thing. So this one's pretty much confirmed if that is the case. And as far as what it looks like, I mentioned, you know, it's 19 pins, pretty small. Some of the sites were saying it looks about the size of a Thunderbolt connector, but it's not Thunderbolt compatible. So again, some people were speculating maybe Apple's just going to a standardized Thunderbolt port. That doesn't seem to be the case either. It seems to be something entirely new. Unfortunately, this means that all the old 30-pin accessories are going to be obsolete. People are going to have to buy new accessories. That's not something Apple's ever been afraid of doing in the past. And I think they're obviously doing this for, in a lot of ways, design reasons. But also, it seems like to exert a little bit more control over the accessory market. Make sure that they're approved by Apple. A lot of people are going to speculate that it also has a lot to do with licensing. And I would completely agree with that. Apple wants to keep the money rolling in. They want to make sure that they can get licensing for the connectors and things like that. So that's another revenue stream. And like it or not, they're going to want to keep control over that as well. Rumors surfaced along with some other sites claiming that they have images and video of the actual new iPhone back case, and there's a lot of information contained in there. If this turns out to be the actual unit, it looks like it is a single unibody piece, so no longer separate pieces where the sort of mid-plate or mid-plane is separate from the back panel like on the current iPhone 4S. By merging the two together and having kind of that unibody construction, that's how Apple is able to reduce the size. They can fit more components in a smaller space. In terms of the physical dimensions, it's the same width, but true to some of the other rumors we were hearing earlier, it does appear to be taller. And that means there's probably going to be a slightly larger screen in there. The main portion of the backplate seems to be kind of a metal material. It's black and white. It almost seems like it's that sort of finish that you would have on the aluminum MacBook Pros or on the back of your iPad, kind of that texturized finish. but then colorized in black or kind of a white, more of a silverish, I guess platinum would be a good description for the actual color. But it's only across the middle of the back, and then either end is sort of capped or banded with what I think is white or black plastic. The reports I was reading didn't really confirm what the actual material was. I don't know why they're not using metal for the entire case, possibly for the antennas to give it a little bit more better radio transparency. To me, it almost harkens back a little bit to the design of the original iPhone. You remember how the original iPhone had that all aluminum back case except for the bottom portion that was plastic? Now you've kind of got it on both ends. I'm not so sure how I feel about the look of it. It looks a little, you know, kind of unfinished to me, or just odd. I don't know. Maybe you have to see it in person, and maybe the pictures aren't doing it justice, or maybe it's one of those kinds of designs that will sort of grow on you. As far as what the actual material is, I don't think we really know. I would assume aluminum. You know, there had been rumors for a while that Apple would eventually use the liquid metal technology that they had licensed to build an actual case. And this week, Apple did extend their exclusivity agreement with liquid metal through 2014. Apple gets a perpetual worldwide, fully paid exclusive license to the commercial applications of the liquid metal technology and their intellectual property in the field of electronics products. And they'll now have that through 2014, which is probably a good thing. And the reason why the backplane on the new iPhone probably isn't liquid metal is I think they came out, the folks at Liquid Metal came out and said that they're probably still a few years away from being able to create components with the technology of that sort of size. I think it mostly comes down to sort of scaling up the manufacturing process to keep up with the kind of demands that Apple is going to need on those component parts. But that doesn't mean that Apple won't use the technology in specific pieces and components in the future. And we may even see some of those components, I would imagine, showing up in the iPhone 5. As far as what the actual design looks like, getting some cues from that back case, there's only a single button on the top of the case, the sleep-wake button. The headphone port has actually been moved to the bottom. And also on the bottom, there looks to be some redesigned speaker grills. And of course, the smaller opening, that's that new dock connector. It's kind of a small oval shape. The volume buttons and the mute rotation lock button seem to be about the same. And then there's also a smaller SIM slot, or what appears to be a smaller SIM slot. It's probably Apple moving to the new micro SIM, which was, I think, a specification was just accepted by the ETSI. They approved a new smaller micro SIM format, so it's likely going to be that format that's in there. Another interesting thing is that there's a tiny hole between the rear camera lens and the flash. Speculation on that is it might be another mic to kind of let you capture better audio when you're taking videos. It could also be used, I would imagine, for some of the noise cancellation stuff, and just making better phone calls. Along with the back case, a new front glass piece also surfaced, and there you can notice that the FaceTime camera on the front has been centered above the earpiece. The glass is taller, but appears not to be edge to edge. It still has kind of that little black line on either side. But in terms of the actual size of it, it does seem to indicate that the new display resolution will be 1136 by 640, 3.999 inch. Can we just call it 4 inch? A 4 inch diagonal display. And it still does apparently have the standard round home button along the bottom, so no move to kind of a touch button, or the button doesn't appear to be going away. I think that's kind of become a signature of the iPhone, so I don't know, it's almost like a design element at this point. I don't know if Apple could totally ever get rid of it, but the new iPhone 5 looks like it's shaping up in terms of the hardware. Obviously, we don't know what's going to be on the internals, but the CEO of Foxconn this week, and admittedly, he's probably a little bit biased, but came out and said that the new iPhone 5 is going to trump the new Galaxy S3, which just came out from Samsung. So I think any way you look at it, you know, there's going to be a lot of excitement and hype around the new iPhone 5. And just seeing some of the components and stuff come out is getting the hype machine rolling a little bit early in advance of the fall release. Apple's getting quite a bit of negative press this week because of an incident that happened at an Apple retail store in Georgia. There, an employee recently refused to sell an iPad to an Iranian-American student after she was speaking Farsi to her uncle in the store. And the employee came over and asked her what language she was speaking. She explained it was Farsi and that she was Iranian. And at that point, the employee claimed that he couldn't sell her any Apple products because, and I think the direct quote was something like, "Our countries have bad relations." And so immediately that kind of ignited a firestorm with sites making allegations that Apple is racially profiling their customers and won't sell and that it's bigoted and all these other things, you know, that start happening after this sort of information comes out. The local news came in and did a story, and unfortunately they did find another customer who had been denied for similar reasons. I was actually alerted to the story by a MacCast listener who was extremely upset by the story, and I would say rightfully so. But the thing is, and you know from listening to the MacCast, that it's easy to get charged up over these stories. Sensational headlines come out, and you don't necessarily have all the facts or the information. And so I wanted to dig in and find out what was going on and maybe make some, you know, we're going to make some assumptions because we don't know. Apple hasn't commented on the story yet, and so we have to kind of assume some things. We know for sure that the incident happened and probably happened more than once, at least in Georgia. Apple has hundreds of retail stores, though, so you have to remember. And so the question is this a standing policy? Is it something that Apple's doing across the board? And I think what kind of took the story a little bit further is Apple does actually have an official policy that we'll talk about in a minute regarding this, but I don't think it's quite as nefarious as maybe some of the stories are letting on. So I will tell you that I feel if a retail store or its employees are doing something or acting in a way where they're denying business to a customer based on their race or based on their citizenship, something like that, that is horrific, and it's something that needs to be changed, and Apple would need to be called out on. People are already calling for Apple to be boycotted and, again, claiming that they're doing racial profiling. When I dug in, here's what I discovered. Apple does have a stated policy on their website about certain countries that the U.S. government has trade embargoes against, and specifically it says that the U.S. holds complete embargoes against Cuba, Iran, North Korea, Sudan, and Syria. The exportation, re-exportation, sale, or supply directly or indirectly from the United States or by a U.S. person, wherever located, of any Apple goods, software technology, including technical data or services, to any of these countries is strictly prohibited without prior authorization of the U.S. government. This prohibition also applies to any Apple-owned subsidiary or any subsidiary employee worldwide. So basically they're saying they can't export products to those countries, but I don't believe Apple would have an open policy of profiling customers in their retail stores and refusing to sell to them. So my best guess of what's going on here, and here's where my assumption comes into play, and I could be completely wrong on this, but is that we have an incident of one regional Apple store. And it may be a case where the management has sort of overstepped the bounds of the export compliance policy. And it might just be because they really didn't fully understand what that policy meant. It's very likely that the employee that was, you know, denying this person the sale, he was told by his management, hey, you can't sell to people from Iran because we have this policy. But that's in reading it, that's obviously a misinterpretation of the policy. But I could have, you know, logically that sounds more like the kind of thing that would happen than purely Apple saying, we're going to racially profile our customers and we're going to deny sales to anybody who isn't speaking English and who, if we go up to and ask them, you know, what language are you speaking? They say, Farsi, I'm from Iran, that we can't sell products to them, especially when it's an Iranian-American. And it's really not an employee's place to have to verify citizenship or anything like that. And I really don't believe that Apple would have that sort of policy. If they come back out and say otherwise, that yes, this is their policy and they're going to continue doing it, then I think there should be a huge outcry against this. But we're going to have to just wait and see on that. You know, is that employee racist? Is the management at that Apple store racist? I don't think we really can know from this one incident, and we shouldn't assume that way either. What's clear to me is that it really isn't Apple's place to act as an agent for the U.S. government in their retail stores. I think that can happen outside. You could say to a customer, hey, here's our export compliance policy. Make sure that, you know, you don't, if you buy something here, you can't export it to one of these countries. And I completely understand Apple, the company, through their direct sales, complying with the U.S. embargoes to their countries. Obviously, Apple shouldn't be shipping countries directly to those countries, but it's not their place to control somebody buying something in the retail store and then taking it outside the retail store and doing something with it. That's really none of their business, and Apple shouldn't be that sort of police force for the U.S. government. We have agents and government employees that handle that sort of thing. And that's why also I find it hard to believe that Apple would be doing that sort of thing, or just for anybody to assume that Apple's going to take that position. Knowing the company, knowing how they operate, knowing their sort of social and philanthropic efforts and the kinds of things that they support, I highly doubt that this is a stated policy. So again, if we just stick to the facts and we sort of stick with logic, I think cooler heads can prevail. And until we have legitimate verified information, I just, you know, I caution anybody to just jumping to conclusions or sort of letting passion take over. Let's call them out when we know legitimately that they're doing an injustice. But until then, I think we have to assume that this is some sort of mistake or actually isolated incident. It could certainly be an isolated incident. And if they come to find out that this employee was doing racial profiling, or this store was doing racial profiling, there definitely should be some serious reprimands and some serious changes that happen within Apple's retail operations. But let's wait for that information to come out before we get all excited. So the new Retina MacBook Pro, I think by far, is one of the coolest laptops Apple has ever made. It is amazing. The Retina display, from all accounts, is a sight to behold. But at least one organization really is not happy with the new Retina MacBook Pro, and that is iFixit. Actually, they like it a lot, but as far as, you know, one of their core things is all about how upgradable is it? How much can you get in there and do repairs? How easy is it to repair? They do an analysis of products, and they gave the Retina MacBook Pro one of the worst scores ever. They basically say, you know, this thing is proprietary, it's sealed, it's locked, it's not meant to be gotten into, and there's lots of factors that point into it. So if you're the type of person with your notebooks that you want to be able to upgrade your RAM, you want to be able to do updates, and you want to have repairs that aren't extremely costly, then you may want to avoid the new Retina MacBook Pro and go with the standard MacBook Pro, which is much more accessible. iFixit gave that a much better score in terms of serviceability and upgradability. When they did do their teardown, they discovered that, you know, it does, the new Retina MacBook Pro has a huge battery, 95 watt hour battery cells, but they're glued to the case. You actually had to pry them up to get them off. And with doing that, you risk potentially damaging the trackpad cable, which is actually down there underneath all of that glue. Apple will let you get a new battery through them, through their battery replacement program, but the MacBook Pro, the Retina MacBook Pro, is the most expensive one now that Apple does. It's $199 US when you're going to need to get a new battery. So you're going to want to factor that into the purchase price. Know that in 2 or 3 years, you're probably going to have to swap out the battery, and you're going to have to pay another $200 for the privilege. Another thing about the Retina MacBook Pro, in order to get that slim design, there aren't standard RAM modules in there. They're actually soldered. The RAM is actually soldered to the motherboard. So you're going to want to make sure that you order it with the amount of RAM that you want. So if you want the 16 gigabytes, you have to get it build to order with 16 gigs in place. You're not going to be able to add that after the fact. So you're going to have to pay Apple's $200 price. Luckily, Apple isn't charging a huge price premium on RAM. It's a little bit more expensive, I think, than you could get third party, but not too bad. But definitely don't skimp on the RAM. It does come standard with 8 gigabytes, which I think is going to serve most people pretty well for the next few years. But if you need the 16, go for it and buy it right up front. The SSDs are also on a card, which is good news, which means there's potential that you could swap out for a larger SSD drive at some point. But it is a proprietary shape, and it's different than the MacBook Air. So third parties are going to have to update and make specialized units. That will likely mean that those SSDs are going to be a little bit more expensive than standard off-the-shelf SSDs that you might be able to put into other laptops, and including the regular MacBook Pro, the 15-inch and 13-inch MacBook Pros. So again, a little bit more expensive on the repair and upgrade side. The good news is that the SSD drives do use the same connectors as the latest edition of the MacBook Airs, not the older models. So there's potential that third parties could save a little bit in terms of using the same kinds of connectors. Another thing that iFixit didn't like about the new Retina MacBook Pro, and this actually came up in the keynote, is that the display is actually fused together with, I think, the back case. It's all kind of one assembly, one unit. So that does mean if something happens to your screen, if you crack the screen, it's going to be a more costly and expensive repair. You're probably also going to want to make sure that you get AppleCare on this one, because if there is an issue with the screen outside that first year warranty, it's going to be costly, even more costly than just buying a new LCD unit and having that slipped into the case. So just be aware of that. And like the newer iPhones, the Retina MacBook Pro uses those specialized pentalobe screws. So you have to even have a special tool to get in there to even maybe attempt an upgrade, which is going to be extremely difficult once you even get inside. So Apple's really saying, look, these are not upgradable units. They're not user serviceable units. If you want that sort of thing, you're probably the Retina MacBook Pro is not going to be for you, which is interesting to me, because not having upgradability, at least in terms of RAM and hard drives, is not a very pro-like feature to me. It seems more like a MacBook Air style feature. So certainly this one is the marriage of the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro. And on the upgrade serviceability side, it looks like it's taking more of its cues from the MacBook Air. And with that, I think that's all I got for the news for this week. I got some great feedback on the last episode, the WWDC Three Amigos episode with Ken Ray and Victor Cajiao. A lot of you wrote in to talk about the Mac Pro discussion that we had, and to actually defend Apple and defend the Mac Pro. I was particularly harsh on it, I think, and I think I still kind of feel that Apple is abandoning their Pro customers. I was delighted to hear from a number of you saying that you're still very happy with Apple and what they're doing, and you're willing to wait to see what they have in store until 2013. A lot of people pointed out the rumors and stories that came out that Apple is still planning a Pro update, that they just didn't get to talk about it at WWDC. A lot of that stemmed from an email a customer had sent to Tim Cook, and he got a reply, Tim saying that we're going to have some new stuff in 2013. And for clarity, I want to point out some specific text of that email, because a lot of the reports are saying that Tim Cook said there's a Mac Pro update coming in 2013. What was actually technically in the email, and I don't say this to discourage anyone, but I just want to point something out. It said, although we didn't have a chance to talk about the new Mac Pro at today's event, don't worry, as we're working on something really great for later next year. And if you notice that, he says, we didn't talk about the Mac Pro, we're working on something for later next year. He doesn't specifically call out that they're working on a new Mac Pro, just something. So it could be a new Pro line, could be a new Mac Pro, or it could be something completely different. The context that the letter was written in makes you assume it's a Mac Pro, but I also have to wonder if the words that are in that email aren't deliberately chosen, because Apple is very careful about how they write things. So just something to note, nothing to get overly concerned about. But I do think I still need to be critical of Apple and the fact that they could have done a lot more for their pro customers, even in just revving the current model. Just bumping up the processors in the token way that they did, I still say is almost a slap in the face to the pro customers. And then on top of that, turning around and saying, hey, you're going to have to wait another 6 months before we're going to do anything else. And you've already been waiting 2.5 years to get any kind of major updates, or 2 years at this point, and it's going to be another half a year. So getting on, moving towards 3 years for a pro update, a significant pro update. You know, they could have at least thrown in Thunderbolt, maybe mini DisplayPort, and hey, how about even adding something like HDMI too? That would have been a really nice little addition, and I don't think would have been that extreme to add to that model. So those are the kinds of indicators that are saying to me that Apple's really not looking at their pro market as one of their core markets anymore. And I'm really afraid that beyond those of you who are really diehard fans and diehard pro fans, I think Apple's going to lose a lot of customers in the interim, and it's much harder to gain those customers back after you've sort of burned them and they've moved on to other platforms and they're doing other things. So Apple either doesn't care or is just being naive, and I have this feeling that they're not naive, and that's just my two cents. But I'm very glad and was very nice to hear from so many of you saying that you're happy with what Apple's doing on the pro side of the market, and you're willing to wait to see what they've got in store for next year. And I can't wait to see what they're up to as well. I hope it's something truly spectacular, and that they'll win back a lot of customers when they do it. Now, speaking of a pro system, the new Retina MacBook Pro, I think for all intents and purposes, is definitely a pro system. It's targeted at pros. It's got a lot of horsepower under the hood. It's got that amazing screen with, 2880 by 1800 pixels resolution in a 15.4-inch screen. Out of the box, though, you're not going to be able to see all of those pixels, at least not running at that native resolution. Apple actually goes for more detail and, I would argue, more readable text by setting the effective resolution of the display to 1440 by 900, which is just like their current 15-inch displays, except now you've got, quadruple the pixels in that same area, so you're really densely packing in the pixels, which gives you that great, crisp resolution, but then you don't end up with this kind of teeny tiny text that you can't actually read. It actually turns out that you can go into the new display system preferences, and they have kind of some default options, a sort of new look. You don't pick specific resolutions. You kind of have a slider and I think some different buttons that you can click in to do different resolutions that Apple's kind of predefined for specific applications. So if you need a little more screen real estate, you can get that. But Apple's default options still won't let you go all the way up to the full 2880 by 1800 native resolution. It's not a choice in the new system preference panel. So it turns out there's actually some third-party tools now that you can run if you want to get that eye-squinting native resolution. If you want to see every individual pixel and what the user interface would look like or what your apps would look like with using that massive native resolution, you can get a tool called Change Resolution from Wineskin, and I'll have links to these in the show notes at maccast.com, or Switch Res X. And I don't know how particularly practical running your new Retina MacBook Pro at that resolution would be. From everything I'm reading, it's just you end up with super, super tiny elements on the screen. I can only imagine, you know, running that high of a resolution on a 15-inch display. But you can actually do it, and maybe in some instances it'll help for, you know, putting up multiple windows or having multiple items up there on the screen. I guess if you're looking at video or images like that, or photos or something like that, it could come in handy to be able to switch to that resolution. So you actually technically can, but definitely not using the native tools that are built into OS X. Now, one truly useful thing, though, if you need additional screen real estate, and Macworld pointed this out, is that you can use all those ports that you got on there. You got the two Thunderbolt ports as well as the HDMI port, and you can actually hook up three external monitors. You can hook up two Thunderbolt displays or two cinema displays, or you can mix and match those on the Thunderbolt ports. And then you can even add a third display on the HDMI port. So you can have your 55-inch LCD TV along with your two 27-inch Thunderbolt displays along with the 15-inch Retina display all running and operating all at the same time. Now, Macworld pointed out that they didn't test performance yet, although I did read some other reports that at least running three displays, two on the Thunderbolt ports and one on the HDMI port, that performance seemed pretty good. And so it's looking like the MacBook Pro, the Retina MacBook Pro, has plenty of horsepower under the hood to make that happen and to drive all those displays. So that's good news and definitely another one of those kind of truly pro features. Normally on the MacCast, I don't venture outside of Apple territory. I don't talk about non-Apple products, but this last week I kind of felt I need to make some commentary on the Microsoft announcement. Microsoft came out this week. They did a big announcement of their new Surface tablets. They're getting a lot of buzz and could potentially be, I think, a legitimate new competitor in the tablet space for the iPad. At least when you just kind of take the hype machine, and there was definitely a lot of hype. It was almost like an Apple event in terms of the hype, and I guess that's one of the first things that kind of annoyed me about the Microsoft Surface and its announcement. Not only the style of the announcement, but also just the device itself and the sort of slavish copying by Microsoft, which shouldn't be surprising. It's nothing really new or unexpected. They've done it in the past, and I'm sure there's going to be some impending patent suits filed, but I hate that sort of thing, so I don't want to really talk about that side of things. But, you know, the announcement itself, just the presentation style, the keynote, definitely not as polished as an Apple keynote, but they definitely seem to be taking cues from what Apple does with their product announcements. Even up to and including sort of keeping it secret till the very last minute, Microsoft took it to an extra extreme level where the media didn't even know up to hours before the event when and where it was happening. So they were definitely able to generate this hype and buzz. But the presentation itself, not at all as polished. There was one point where the device completely locked up and the engineer sort of giving the presentation had to run back, or I can't remember specifically who was giving the presentation, but he had to run back and get a backup device. Just waking it from sleep, it locked up. And that's not surprising because, as you'll hear later, this announcement was really, really early. They have a new cover for the thing that looks surprisingly like a smart cover, has a magnetic latching mechanism, comes in different colors. The where it attaches, there's a connector on there that actually carries data and both data and power, but looks surprisingly like a kind of large MagSafe connector. Clicks in there with a magnet, so they're borrowing stuff there. Another thing that was really shocking and probably the biggest announcement, well, two of the biggest things and biggest changes for Microsoft were, one, that they're doing now their own hardware and software, kind of a complete 180. And Ballmer even came out and sort of said, look, you know, we control the software and we innovate the software very quickly. And a lot of times our partners can't seem to keep up with our innovation. So we're going to have to go ahead and innovate. And that's why we're doing this product. And there was speculation immediately that Microsoft was really just trying to light a fire under their hardware partners to kind of show them what a Windows 8 tablet should look like and what it should be or what Microsoft expects it to be, and trying to get them to really push the envelope on it and say, look, hey, if you're not going to push the envelope for us, we're going to have to do it ourselves, and we're more than willing to do it. So they might have burned a few bridges with some of their hardware partners. But I think ultimately, what Microsoft is realizing and doing this sort of 180 on, it just, it annoys me because Ballmer was so adamant that what Apple was doing was it's closed and they're not doing the right thing. And, you know, we're open and we just do software and we let our partners kind of decide where to take that on the hardware side. And we work with them. And now they're doing this whole closed thing. And I think they realize that there's a lot of power in that. And you can really do some great things when you control the whole product end to end. So I guess they've gained enlightenment, but it's just frustrating because it's like this flip-flop 180 sort of thing. And the whole project was supposedly, and I think obviously executed with Apple-like, I would say even better than Apple-like secrecy, because we really didn't hear anything about this till the announcement happened. As for how it looks, the device itself, it's thin, very thin on the one model that is using the ARM-based processors. But I thought it also kind of looked boxy. It still has that kind of PC heritage you can see in the design with the kind of extra ports all the way around. And it just not as sleek and elegant as an iPad, at least in my opinion. Another thing that Jeff Gamet pointed out, and I didn't notice at first, was it looks like it is really designed mainly to operate in landscape mode. It has this kickstand on the back that allows it to stand up, and that sort of folds in behind it. That's actually a really interesting design. Again, I think it kind of detracts because you've got this extra like line and edges, and those are the kinds of things that Apple doesn't like in its designs, but it is pretty neat that it integrates in pretty nicely to the back case. But that kickstand comes out and really only works in the landscape mode. Also, the keyboard covers are designed so that the keyboard's kind of on the inside of the cover, so when you fold it out, it's going to only work in landscape mode as well. And during the whole event, they really didn't demo the device in portrait mode. So I don't know if that means it's only designed to operate in landscape mode, but that may make sense considering that I think Microsoft isn't thinking about this just as a tablet. It's also trying to push it on the PC side, and I think that's actually a little bit of a problem. The naming also leaves something to be desired, but naming products has never been Microsoft's forte. They have two different models. One is an ARM-based one, and one is going to be an Intel-based one. The ARM-based one is going to run the Windows RT software, which is the lighter weight version of Windows, and the other one is going to run Windows 8, I think the full version of Windows 8. So they're going to be called the Surface for Windows RT and the Surface for Windows Pro. Now, I think you could also argue that Apple, especially with its recent naming of the new iPad, you know, that's not the best naming in the world, but maybe a little bit better than Surface for Windows RT or Surface for Windows Pro. I don't know. We can debate on that one. I'm not gonna bash them too much on that point. I do think that they announced way too early, though. Product, just in terms of demoing, seemed very early, almost alpha, not really beta, based on some of the crashes and some of the issues that they had. They didn't have any pricing available. They didn't have any availability, so we don't know when this thing is coming out. The touch keyboard covers, they wouldn't let any of the media use, so I don't even know if they were functional or not. And I have this feeling that the hype could wear off. They generated a lot of buzz and hype around this event, but it could eventually wear off before this product even hits the market. And, you know, I don't know what they're going to do if they actually slip the date that they have in mind. Most people are speculating that they're going to try and bring this thing out around the holidays, and they're coming out, it sounds like, with the Windows RT version first. But if they slip that date, which they're apt to do, they could end up with sort of egg on their face. Overall, you know, I think the design looks nice. It's nice to see another competitor hitting the market. Unfortunately, they gave us very little to go on in terms of specifications. Like I said, we know that the RT model is going to be using an ARM-based processor. It sounds like it's going to be one from NVIDIA using the Tegra technology, but they didn't give us any speed details. On the Pro side, it's going to be an Intel processor, but we don't know which processor, what the speed of that processor is going to be. The resolutions of the two devices, they're 16:9 aspect ratios. They said there's going to be an HD model, which is the RT model, and a full HD, which is the Pro model. No specifics on resolution. I think we can assume HD means 1280 by 720, and full HD might mean 1920 by 1080. Didn't get any details on the RAM, the battery, whether or not you can expand the storage. They did have, I believe, 32 and 64 gigabyte models, as well as on the Pro side, 128 gigabyte model in terms of the built-in flash storage. Don't know if they're going to be cellular. Don't know resolutions on the cameras. So, see, just a lot of details aren't there. So you really can't start to make comparisons against some of the current products that are on the market. They did tell us what ports are going to be in there. There's going to be a micro HD port for the RT model and a mini display port on the Pro model for the video out. And then you have USB 2.0 in the RT model, which is interesting, but standard USB ports, and then USB 3 ports in the Pro model. To me, like I said, the design looks cool enough. The keyboard cover, especially the touch-based one that's super thin, that looks like a smart cover with a keyboard almost printed on the inside, that looks like a really cool concept. And if it works as well as they say it does, then I think that's a feature that I'm hoping Apple might steal back from Microsoft. It'd be cool if your smart cover flipped around and turned right into a keyboard. I don't think, though, that Microsoft, even themselves, seems to know what they want the product to be. And I think that ultimately could be a problem for them. You know, it's a tablet and it's a sub notebook. It's a pen device and it's a touch device. And it's also a notebook device with a keyboard. It's priced like a tablet, and it's also priced like a sub notebook. I'm not sure I think it's right, but Microsoft is clearly taking this sort of polar opposite approach on tablets from Apple. They're trying to have their tablet sort of be all things to all people, as opposed to Apple saying, look, we're going to focus on making this new device that's a touch device, it's a tablet, and it's going to serve a different purpose and operate differently than a notebook. And that's definitely divergent from what Microsoft is doing. They're saying this is a single device that fulfills almost both purposes. And you can use it like a tablet and you can use it like a notebook. And that's a strategy they took originally when they first launched tablets. It's different in terms of form factor this time, but I think ultimately, only time will tell what consumers think. The Surface tablets, though, definitely have this bipolar identity, and it's likely going to go one or two ways. It's either going to be a huge success with consumers, or that cross-functionality is going to be its greatest downfall. I think I've kind of bought in to the iPad Mac strategy, having used the devices for, you know, almost 3 years now. I'm pretty well convinced of what Tim Cook says, and that's that you have to kind of let go the PC legacy before you can make these devices truly shine and truly be what they're supposed to be. You know, I've tried to do the hybrid thing. I've tried using Bluetooth keyboards and keyboard docks and styluses with my iPad. But beyond some specialized applications, I think styluses are great for drawing applications, but definitely not something that you need to use on a daily basis. And if handwriting recognition doesn't get better, it doesn't work all that great. I do use NoteShelf and really like that for taking written notes. But again, these are really specific applications, and more I'm finding that the best apps that I have on my device are the ones that take full advantage of the native touch user interface and do that in really clever ways that use fingers and gestures, and those are the apps that I tend to gravitate toward and find that I'm most productive with. So Tim Cook's comments that, you know, in order to make this better device, you can't be bogged down by the old PC technologies, I think is the right approach. Microsoft is obviously doing something different with these tablets, and it's going to be interesting to see what they do and how consumers respond to them. I think it's just unfortunate we're going to have to wait a really long time, or at least 6 months, if not longer, to find out, you know, who's right. So I don't know. That's my take. I'm sure you have some thoughts and opinions on it. Please send me some feedback. Let me know what you think of these new tablets. Are they going to make a difference, or is Apple still going to continue to dominate? Send me feedback, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last item I have for you today is kind of, you know, I don't do a lot of reviews on the Maccast, but I found a product that I'm kind of excited about. This is really just a first look because it literally just came in the mail yesterday. But I wanted to tell you about the product because I'm excited about where it came from and the device itself. You know, if you're like me, you're constantly looking for power, for places to plug in your iPhone, to plug in your iPad. And, you know, because of that, I have a lot of battery cases. I absolutely love my Mophie juice pack. I would not have my iPhone without one. Every one of my iPhones I've used a juice pack with. And it's really not for daily use. It's for those times when I'm traveling. I know I'm not going to be readily near a place to plug in and get some power. And it's just those times I need a little extra juice or my battery's running low and I want to extend my day, my productivity for the day. And it's become a problem, though, with the new iPad because the new iPad has bigger charging requirements. And if you want to charge it at any kind of decent rate, you need to have more amperage flowing into that thing. So most battery products don't work with the new iPad, or they're really slow to charge up the new iPad. So I was really excited when somebody tweeted out that Monoprice is selling a 5,000 milliamp hour battery pack. And we've talked about Monoprice on the show in the past. It's an awesome place to get cables. Don't pay too much for cables. Go to monoprice.com. They have all kinds of cables for all kinds of applications. Great company. So it was great to see them doing a battery product. And so what I'm planning to do is I'm heading to Scott Johnson and Frog Pants Studios' Nerdtacular event. I'm actually going to be leaving here in just a couple hours, actually less than an hour at this point. Got to get on a flight at 6:15 in the morning, flying out to Utah. And I'm going to be taking, I got two of them, I'm going to be taking them with me, and I'll let you know how they perform and how they do. But I wanted to tell you about some of the features and just give you some of my first impressions on opening the box. So the key feature for me beyond the capacity, which is amazing, 5,000 milliamp hours is very significant in terms of the capacity of the product. But it was the fact that it has two USB charging ports. And one of the ports is a 5-volt, 1-amp charging port, which will charge an iPhone at its full rate, just like it was plugged into the wall charger. And then more importantly, it also has a 2.1-amp 5-volt port for charging the iPad at a full rate. Now, I believe that the new iPad's battery is almost 12,000 milliamp hours in terms of capacity. So this is only going to add about another half of that to the iPad. So you're not going to be able to fully charge an iPad with just one of these. Part of the reason why I got two of them, so I could get pretty close to charging the new iPad, I think, with both batteries. But the iPhone 4S just has about a 1500 milliamp hour battery. So this will charge an iPhone several times back up to full capacity. As far as how you charge the battery pack itself, it just plugs in with a micro USB cable, so that's pretty standard and straightforward. As far as the physical size of the battery pack, it's about a quarter inch wider than the iPhone, about the same height as the iPhone, and just a little less than twice the thickness of my iPhone 4S. So definitely small, still portable. It has four blue LEDs on the front and a home button, what looks like a home button. It's actually the on-off button and the battery status button. So if you tap it, the little blue LEDs light up to show you how much charge the battery has in it. If you press and hold it on, that'll turn it on and start charging your device. It comes in black or white, and it kind of has the soft rubberized texture to it. I don't know how to describe that texture, but a lot of electronics have it now, so it's very nice to the touch. It even came in some pretty nice packaging. And another nice feature that I read about was that if you have it powered on and you're charging your device, when the device reaches full charge, it's smart enough to know to stop charging, so you're not going to deplete your battery pack by leaving it plugged in even after your device has reached 100% charge. About my only early complaint is that the little button on the front, the home button, is pretty recessed. It's pretty deep in there, and it does feel a little bit wobbly, which makes it feel a little bit cheap. But the rest of it, the blue LEDs and just the overall construction, it feels solid and very well made. And I guess I probably left the, I give you a little sleeper feature to leave as the one more thing on this on this review, and that is the price. Because it's coming from Monoprice, the battery pack is just $28.95 US. So a lot of charging power, a lot of flexibility for $30. That is what really sold me on it. So I'll come back and I'll tell you how they perform, how well they do while I'm traveling, but I expect good things out of these little battery packs, and I'd be shocked if it came out otherwise. All right, so that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Check out their software as well as get a free trial over at CircusPonies.com. Smile Software, Grab Text Expander 4, new version out just today or just yesterday. And also, while you're there, check out all of their other great products. They have free trials available. You can get more information over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, you get cash for your old smartphones, your iPhones, your Mac products. You can do it simply and easily. Just go to gazelle.com, do a search, get a quote. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. After 400 episodes, I appreciate you still hanging out with me, still listening. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, any suggestions, anything you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on our listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Please leave your email address and spell it out for me. That way, if I need to get back to you, if I need to follow up on anything, I can do that. Also, be sure to check out the MacCast website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast. You can find the site at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum. Recently redesigned, great community of Mac users over there. If you have a technical question, if you need help with something, that's a great resource to go to. If you're looking for a piece of software, folks over there are really, really great. So if you haven't been over there, check it out. It's free to sign up, free to participate. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the maccast.com Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/themaccast. And I'm personally really enjoying the Facebook page. There I'm trying to post videos, put up little interesting tidbits that I find as I'm doing my research, stuff that I normally wouldn't take time to cover on the show. So it is a lot of extra additional content. If you're on Facebook, it's easy. Just, you know, like the page or, you know, whatever they do, subscribe to the page. They're always changing it, so I can never keep up with that sort of thing. But become a fan. Is that what they're doing now? Anyway, head over there. And that's going to do it for now. I need to go jump on a plane, head to Utah for Nerdtacular. If you're going to be at Nerdtacular, I hope to see you there. Love to chat with you. Come up, say hi. And that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.